This morning, before we begin the first lecture, I'd like to bring a little devotional thought. In the scripture, the various Bible writers characterize the ways of God variously. True and just, marvelous, past finding out. And this morning I had an experience that brought a memory back 14 years ago, right here on this campus, something that happened to me just outside the building we're in right now. You all have seen the oval athletic track out here. Well, I took a couple of laps around it this morning, and it brought back something that happened to me on that track 14 years ago this month that I wanted to share with you to illustrate how marvelous are God's ways. It was the summer of 1972. I was given a little leave in the summer while teaching at Pacific Union College to come back and take a couple of courses in the seminary for intellectual stimulation and information. You know, it's good for teachers every so often to go back and sit on the other side of the desk in the classroom and know what it's like to be a student. I think it will make you more sensitive to students. And knowing that having spent a number of years in Michigan when I did postgraduate study at Michigan State University, I knew that there would be a temptation to spend a lot of my time accepting invitations for guest speaking. And knowing my own weaknesses, when I drove here, I left all of my sermon notes in Englewood, so that if I were asked, I could say, I don't even have any sermon notes with me, thank you. I have to discipline myself sometimes. I did plan to spend one Sabbath while I was here in July in East Lansing. I went to school 3.5 years at Michigan State University, 2 quarters in 1962, and then for 3 years, 1964 to 67. During part of that time, 13 months of that period, I acted as acting pastor of the East Lansing Church. And so I wrote ahead to the wife of the treasurer of the Michigan Conference, in whose home I would be a guest for the weekend, Vi Wartzog. And I said, Vi, I am not going to speak this Sabbath. I haven't even brought any sermon notes with me. I'm just coming up for fellowship. And I'm just so busy with my study program at Andrews that I don't have time to prepare a new sermon, and I didn't bring any sermon notes. I'm just coming up for fellowship. Friday morning, as was my custom, before breakfast, I was staying right in this building, in this dormitory. And Friday morning, I went out, as I generally did every morning, to take about 8 or 10 laps around the oval track for exercise. And as I was on about the second or third lap, the Lord spoke to me. When I say this, some of you may raise your eyebrows. It was not an audible voice. But you know, the Lord does have ways of talking to us. Incidentally, we have ways of talking back. Have you ever talked back at the Lord? I'm afraid I was impudent that morning. And the Lord said to me, as I was making my circuit for about the third time around that oval track, the Lord said, Roger, you're going to preach tomorrow. And I laughed at the Lord, like Abraham's wife Sarah. She laughed. She did it in the tent. She laughed. And I said, Lord, I said, you surely know that I don't have any sermons here. I left all my sermon outlines in Anguin. I don't have anything. It's Friday. I said, tomorrow I'm going to preach. I said, Lord, you know, this is a funny joke. About the third lap around, he said, yes, Roger, you're going to speak. And I said, Lord, I don't have any sermons. He said, this is what you're going to speak on. And he gave me the topic. Kept going around the laps. About the fourth lap, he said, I've given you the topic. Now, this is the way we're going to divide the topic. And he gave me the four main divisions of the sermon. Kept going around the track. Then he said, now in the first division, you're going to develop it this way. And as we were going around together, he gave me the development of each of the four sections. He gave me the texts for each of the four sections of the sermon. He gave me illustrations for each of the four sections. And by the time we got done, he gave me the introduction and the conclusion, and I ran, I did not walk, to my room in this dormitory and quickly put it all down on paper before I forgot it. I mean, you know, you don't want to take any chances. right outside. You know, it might do wonders for you. So I went to breakfast, still laughing, because incidentally, I did tell the Lord one thing. I said, okay, Lord, like William Miller. William Miller said, all right, Lord, he said, if I'm asked, I will, but I won't unless I'm asked. And I said, Lord, I'm not going to be asked because I've already sent word ahead that I'm not preaching. So I went to my classes. No, Friday we didn't have classes in the seminary. I guess I left about 10 o'clock to drive up to Lansing. It's a good three and a half hours drive from here. And I arrived early, mid-afternoon, at the home of Elder and Mrs. Leonard Wartsock. She was there to greet me, and she showed me into the guest room. And as she came in, she said, you know, there are a lot of people here that are unhappy that you aren't going to preach this tomorrow morning. I said, Vi, you know why. She says, yes, I understand. I said, I've been so busy with my study program down at Andrews, I haven't had time to prepare anything. And I said, I didn't bring anything with me. I had not been in her house 30 minutes when the telephone rang. And a young man who was acting pastor and also a doctoral candidate in the university, I've forgotten his name, but he taught Spanish either at PUC or La Sierra later on, got his doctorate in Spanish there. He called up, and I was in the kitchen when Mrs. Wartsog answered the telephone. And she said, called him by name, but she says, he's already told us that he's not going to speak. Well, yes, I'll ask him again, but I don't want to irritate him. He's already told us he's not going to speak tomorrow. So she looked at me and put her hand over the mouthpiece of the telephone, and she said, the man has laryngitis and has totally lost his voice. Could you possibly talk tomorrow? And with a very funny look on my face, I said, yeah, I'll take the service. And she looked as startled as I was, and she said, well, she said, he said he'd do it. The man said he absolutely could not. He had total loss of voice with laryngitis. So when she hung up, she says, what's with you? She said, you told me that you wouldn't. And then I told her what happened that very morning on this track out here. Well, she said, I don't know who the Lord has in mind for that message, but she says it'll be interesting to go to church tomorrow. I didn't know either. I still don't. So the next morning, I was introduced as this preacher. Many of the people that I had known when I'd gone to school there, 64 to 67 and the summer of 62, were there. It was a wonderful reunion, wonderful fellowship. And in the congregation was a minister who I suppose at that point was probably in his early 30s. I knew him, not well, and not really personally. I guess I should rather say I knew who he was rather than knowing him. Anyway, I was rather surprised that he was there. I also learned that he had had and was going through some very great discouragements. And I gave the message 24 hours later that the Lord gave me. I wish I could get all of my sermons that way. It would sure save a lot of hard work. I have only once previously had, and it was in the same church too, East Lansing Church, but I won't take time to share that with you this morning because time's going. But I only once before have had a strikingly remarkable experience such as that. Anyway, I gave the sermon not knowing for whom it was intended by the Lord, but happy that at least one person who was there, who was very, very discouraged at the time, found encouragement in that particular sermon. Today, he is a conference president in his second conference presidency. And the Lord's ways are marvelous, true, just, and past finding out. And I thought about all of this morning, 14 years to the month later, when I took a few more laps. Incidentally, the Lord didn't give me a message for you today. That message has already been given.
How many laps today?
Oh, two or three. I've asked Virginia Collins, who is a church school teacher at Kettering, and a very dear personal friend, she and her husband, were next door neighbors at the Adventist Seminary of West Africa when we started that school in the late 1950s and the early 1960s. And I've asked her if she would lead us in a word of prayer. Let's bow our heads.
Good morning, Father. Thank you that we have the privilege of calling you Father. Thank you that you are going to be with us today, that you have sent your Holy Spirit, that you will be guiding Roger and Bob as they present to us what you've given them to give to us today, and that your Holy Spirit is going to speak to our hearts and help us to learn what we need to learn to be closer to you and to be the kind of people that we should be and the kind of leaders as we go back to our families and to our churches. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Virginia. If you will turn in the little book of outlines to page 116, we're going to consider this morning one of the most remarkable evidences of divine leadership through God's special messenger to this people that I think is found in the entire 70-year ministry of that remarkable lady. I have visited Avondale twice. I was there in 1983, I think it was, and then I was there again last October. In fact, I spoke 12 times in 48 hours on that campus between Sunday night and Tuesday night. And Tuesday night, I had my last meeting was a joint worship for boys and girls dormitories, and it was October 22, and we celebrated a birthday. You know, Francis Nickel in his book Midnight Cry says that October 22 is the birthday of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. So I invited those young people to a birthday party that night, and you know, the Holy Spirit came in that meeting in a marvelous way. I wish I could experience his presence as powerfully every time I speak as I did on that particular occasion. So Avondale brings back some memories for me. By way of introduction, a little background. Ellen White received what she called an impressive dream, California, on April Fool's Day, but what was given was no joke. April 1, 1874. In this vision, Australia was especially singled out as a place that was to become a divinely appointed center from which light was to radiate to many lands. The vision was significant for two reasons. First, the church had never dreamed that it had a worldwide program. Why, we were still 5.5 months away from sending our first missionary to J.N. Andrews. He went to Switzerland. And secondly, the vision was significant because Adventists not only previously thought of a worldwide work, but we had never previously dreamed of the extent to which the printing press would be a significant instrument in giving the three angels messages. So this dream had several points of significance. In 1885, Haskell led a task force of five families to open the work on the Australian continent. And last October, the Australasian, or now it's called the South Pacific Division, commemorated the centenary of the opening of Adventist work, and they did it in Melbourne, where the work began, at Monash University, and a group of about 18 or 19 people who had prepared scholarly papers presented them in a symposium. I was there. I had been asked to write a paper on Ellen White's concept of advance for Australasia, and we presented our papers and we discussed them in a scholarly setting, and these are going to be subsequently published. But 100 years ago, last October, I'm not sure it was October that they arrived. No, it wouldn't have been October. They got there in December. Anyway, 100 years ago, Haskell and five families opened up the work. And Haskell stayed in Australia and New Zealand for 2 years. Then he revisited it during a world tour, 1889 to 90. And when that was over, he spoke to the General Conference session of 1891 at Battle Creek and spoke earnestly about the needs of Australia in particular. And he recommended Ellen White be sent there to pioneer the work. He had a particular thing in mind. They needed a training school. The greatest single need in Australia, and remember the work is just getting started there, the greatest single need that they had was a training school to train workers. The Foreign Mission Board, meeting at the time of the General Conference session, responded to Haskell's appeal by promptly voting Ellen White a call, and also a call for her son Willie. Of course, she could not go without him. When she got the message, she responded by asking the Foreign Mission Board to reconsider its action in the light of three things. First, she was 63 years old and not in the best of health. Secondly, she had a lot of writing to do, especially she wanted to do her book on the life of Christ, which would subsequently be entitled Desire of Ages. And third, the rigors of a 4 to 6 weeks voyage were especially unpleasant. They couldn't get on a Qantas airplane or some other airline and in 18 hours be there from Los Angeles, as I have done twice. 4 to 6 weeks on a boat, and if you are prone to seasickness, this can be devastating. So she asked the Foreign Mission Board to reconsider. It did. And in reconsidering, it reaffirmed its original action, and she accepted. Her policy had been to do what the leading brethren requested unless she had positive light from the Lord to the contrary. And she was hoping, I'm sure, for some word to the contrary, and it never came, so she said, okay. And so they arrived December 8, 1891. Now, the Advent movement was just 6 months shy of celebrating its seventh birthday when she arrived down under. And as I said, the most urgent immediate need was trained workers to conduct the work of the church and a place to train them for this reason. There were, at this point, when she arrived, 20 to 30 young people, Adventist young people. They couldn't get training in their own countries there, and so they privately raised money and crossed the Pacific to get an education. Some went to Healdsburg College in California. Some went to Battle Creek College. The cost per student, now remember, we're talking about 1891. The cost per student was $25,000. That covered transportation, education expense, and everything. And $25,000 then would be an astronomical sum. I mean, that's even a lot of money today, but it was even more in terms of their cost of living and income and so on. But there seemed no alternative at the time. The baptized membership consisted of 494 in Australia, 254 in New Zealand, for a total of 746. The majority of Adventists were tradesmen. They lived in cities and they had problems. When their teenagers finished public school and tried to help support their families financially, it was hard to get jobs or even hard to learn a trade because of Sabbath problems. Economically, the people were not off. They came from modest circumstances, middle class, lower middle class. At this point in time, the British colonies in the South Pacific were passing through a very severe economic depression. Some Adventist working men had been laid off their jobs, and others were able to retain them only by taking substantial cuts in the rate of pay. And now, for this American lady prophet, newly come to their midst, to tell them that they were going to establish a school right there in Australia, well, it was almost laughable if it wasn't pathetic. But the early pioneers were made of sturdy stuff, and a beginning was made. They rented two houses on St. Kilda's Road, George's Terrace in Melbourne, and this is now a main road into Melbourne, rented two houses, and with a staff of five and a student body that shortly would reach 24 within a few days of the opening of school, they opened their makeshift school August 24, 1892, barely 8.5 months after Ellen White arrived in Australia. Now, she was bedridden from January through November of 1892. Now, remember, she arrived in December, and almost as soon as she arrived, she's flat on her back for 11 months, very ill, and she used to cry out to the Lord in the night seasons, "Lord, you know, if I got to stay in bed all the time, I might as well have stayed in America where it's a little more comfortable." She really labored with the Lord, but she submitted. But for this school, for the opening of school, she got up out of her sick bed and gave the opening address. She was seated in a chair, and she astounded everybody that was there. And Daniels talks about this in Abiding Gift of Prophecy, for he was there. And he said, "It just blew our minds." He didn't use that expression, but that's what he meant. to hear that this little school would yet send workers as missionaries from Australia to China, India, South America, and Africa. Incidentally, by the time Daniels wrote his book, 1936, wasn't it? 37? Right along in there. By the time Daniels wrote his book, he could say, we have already sent missionaries from Avondale to all of those places. That early, that was fulfilled. It was a start, but a school of their own seemed impossible. But the conference appointed a search committee to look for land. She received messages from the Lord telling her just what kind of an unusual school this was to be. And by the way, we already had two schools now, actually three. The first school, Battle Creek College, which later became this institution. The second one was Healdsburg College, which later became Pacific Union College with a relocation and change of name. And the third one, within just a couple of days, is what is Atlantic Union College. It started just a few days after PUC. I was public relations director at PUC my first 3 years, and I did a little research because AUC was making noises about being the second school, and they weren't quite correct. I think we established that PUC had an edge of a day or two over them, but they both started in 1882. So, anyway, we had three schools, but the school here at Battle Creek and the school at PUC were not really what Ellen White wanted totally, and she said, we're going to make a model school or a pattern school out of Avondale. Anyway, there were four criteria to determine and guide the location and the development. Location, in the country, a wide distance from the cities. They had to have adequate land because they were going to do a lot of things, farming, gardening, fruit growing, dairying, so on. Industries would be there for student employment, and she specified that it would be a remunerative basis that would be mutually advantageous to the school and to the student. In some institutions, the remuneration is advantageous to the school. In some, it's advantageous to the student, but not the school. Anyway, this was going to be mutually advantageous. And then a philosophy. It would be a program to train the head, the heart, and the hand, and the students would gain skill in occupational work, a right estimate of the value and dignity of manual labor and self-reliance. But there was an apprehensive constituency of leaders and laity. Leaders. A.G. Daniels, union president, wrote, as we study this great outline, we felt it necessary to remind Ellen White, gently, of what it would mean to a small constituency, few of whom even owned their own homes, to purchase high-priced land, erect necessary buildings, and establish, equip, and operate the industries that she was calling for. And we told her, as kindly as they could, I'm sure, that the task seemed utterly impossible. The laity also were concerned. However, they were neither as tactful nor diplomatic as Daniels. And when the plan was presented to a church group in Melbourne, one forthright Aussie told Willie White, and Willie wrote this in a letter later to F.C. Gilbert, this Aussie said, Brother White, this plan of building such a school is not an Australian plan at all. The demand for having such a school is not an Australian demand. The idea of establishing a school at this time, when our cause is so young and weak, this is not an Australian idea. It is a proposition foisted on us by Elder Haskell. Well, he was being gentle. He ultimately had Ellen White in mind, but it was safer to lay it on Haskell than it was on the prophet. Well, it wasn't Haskell's plan. It wasn't Ellen White's plan. It was God's plan. In September, they held a camp meeting near Melbourne. The General Conference president came out, O.A. Olson, to attend. They spent a lot of time discussing plans for this proposed new school. They still had no site. There was much searching and much disappointment. Now, good land was available at a price of about $75 an acre or more. But at that time, that price was astronomical. If you could buy land in Australia today for $75 an acre, you'd run right out there and do it. Buy as much as you could. It's a lot more now. But at that time, $75 an acre was an astronomical sum. No landowner had made any offer within reach of their meager finances, and no community on the continent had any interest in establishing this kind of school. It often happens that communities will give you land or rent it to you at a ridiculously low price because they are interested. The school that Virginia Collins and her husband and I started in Nigeria. I found the land in 57, and Grover Winslow and I were the first two teachers in 59, and I think the Collinses came in 60. The landowners, there were 14 landowning families in Elishan Remo, Nigeria, and they were so interested in having a post-secondary school in their midst that they leased us 370 acres for a shilling, 14 cents, a shilling an acre a year. So they virtually gave us the land because they wanted that kind of a school in Australia. Nobody wanted this kind of a school, and so they were not about to make any concessions on price or encouragement of any kind. And so everywhere, the site selection committee faced indifference and high prices. Now, there was an estate known as the Brettville Estate, about 1,500 acres, at Currumbong, 70, 75 miles north of Sydney. It's about an hour and 20 minutes drive today on a well-paved road. There was a catch, however, for the low price of $3 an acre. It wasn't really a bargain at all. Daniels characterized the land as poor, sandy, and hungry. The search committee was not only disappointed, they were also divided as to whether they should buy it or not. They decided that Ellen White must see the property first, and being prudent, they also decided to commission an independent evaluation by the government's Department of Agriculture. So they took soil samples, sent them to a government testing station, and the report came back, the soil is sour, it will require 1.5 tons of lime per acre to make it productive. No wonder it was $3 an acre when other land was $75. A.H. Benson, a government fruit inspector, was called for an on-site inspection by way of follow-up. The day he came, it was raining. The committee was in a hurry and didn't have much time. He didn't see the best of the place. But anyway, when he got back to his office, he wrote up his opinion, and he said the land has great drawbacks. In the first place, it's expensive to clear. Secondly, when you've cleared it, it's going to require draining and liming to produce satisfactory returns. And third, even when you get the land into the proper condition, it's going to require constant manuring to maintain its fertility. And as Arthur White mentions in Volume 4 of the biography of Ellen White, most of the land was very poor, sour, sandy loam, resting on yellow clay. Some of it was very poor or swamp-covered with different species of Melaleuca, whatever that is. Benson's report goes on. From what I can gather, the objects of the society are to start a colony of a certain sect or denomination and to erect a college in connection with the colony for the purpose of educating missionaries who will receive an agriculture and horticultural training. Therefore, conclusion. In order for the undertaking to be a success, it is my opinion that the society will be unwise to select the land I visited. And when Benson handed this written report to a member of the site selection committee, he remarked in passing that if a bandicoot, it was a marsupial about the size of a rabbit, if a bandicoot were to cross this tract of land, he would find it necessary to carry his lunch with him because he couldn't find anything to eat on the land. I love that story. I would love to have a bandicoot. 2 days after the Benson report, Ellen White herself visited the site for a 2-day visit. Her party included George Starr, Emily Campbell, and a Mr. McKenzie. They arrived late Wednesday morning, May 23, 1894. So before doing anything, they ate lunch. Then they went by boat along Dora Creek for several miles. And Dora Creek is still there today, alive and doing well, for several miles, passing several farms and houses. When they got to the site, the delegation took shovels to examine the soil in different locations on this 1,500 acres of land. At the end of the day, the committee as a whole were much more favorable toward purchase than they previously were. Ellen White was tired, and she was getting on in years, too. She went to bed early that night, and the committee deliberated on into the night. Pros and cons, they finally voted to purchase it. The next morning, however, the committee, I think, was having some second thoughts and maybe even some misgivings. Despite its action to purchase the night before, they felt, let's re-examine the property once again, you know, just for sure. Before they left the cottage, which they'd stayed that night, they met for prayer to ask God's special guidance. And as Ellen White was praying, she felt impressed to plead with God for some token or special evidence that would confirm everybody that they were on the right course, wisdom of proceeding as they had previously voted. And in the group was a young minister who was 21 or 22 years of age, Elder Stephen McCullough. From the records, I find he suffered from a disease of throat and lungs. I think it was tuberculosis. His condition was continuing to deteriorate markedly, and Ellen White felt impressed to pray for his healing. As she prayed, he reported later, a sensation like an electric shock went through his body, and his healing was permanent. Because in 1929, 35 years later, Daniels ran into McCullough on the streets of Sydney, and McCullough reported that he had no reoccurrence of the problem since. I have heard Dr. Olson say he believes McCullough lived at least 50 years after his healing. The committee took the healing as a favorable omen that they had sought, and they rejoiced. And the committee reaffirmed its action of the preceding night, acting, in Ellen White's words, in perfect unity. But there were roadblocks. Willie, of course, had to keep in touch with the Foreign Mission Board. They did not have power to act. This was one of the things that would be corrected at the 19-1 General Conference session. Our work was so highly centralized, and the GC committee consisted of between 3 and 5 men at this time. Was it three? Yeah. And if you wanted to buy a package of paper clips, you almost had to write to Battle Creek for permission and authorization. I mean, the controls were so stringent. And they did not have, even though they were a union conference, they did not have authorization to get the land there. And so Willie had to keep in touch with the Foreign Mission Board. And on June 10, he wrote to them about developments. And he felt he had to give them the total picture, and so he reported the negative report of the government agriculture experts. And incidentally, even after the first down payment was made, the government assistant secretary of agriculture told them, hey, you've made a down payment, but you'd still be farther ahead to forfeit your deposit, and that would be a smaller loss than to proceed with going ahead with this thing. You're absolutely out of your mind going ahead, he said. And Willie, honestly, totally, openly told them of his misgivings and the committee. And he said, we've prayed that if this were the wrong place, something would happen through divine intervention to hedge up the way. I think when the letter got to Battle Creek, they kind of heard an inarticulate cry for help here, and I think that may have been the thing that caused them to vote to suspend operations at the Avondale site. I don't know. Anyway, he said the contract terms, 25 pounds down, 275 pounds due 20 days later, and then the balance due any time in the next 2 years. Well, in late August, Willie got a letter back from F.M. Wilcox, who was the secretary of the Foreign Mission Board, and a letter from Prescott, who was the General Conference Education Director, advising that the committee had said, you better look for some other property that's more promising and discontinue your development at Avondale. You may have to pay a higher price, but okay, but then limit yourself to 40 acres. Don't go for, you know, the 1,500 that you would get if you've got to pay a lot higher price. So settle for less land, even though you pay more, but forget the Currumbong site. And so the site committee voted August 27 to delay Avondale development. And Willie accordingly ordered suspension on the surveying of the land, which was already underway. And the committee voted to examine alternative sites. Ellen White was stunned. And she wrote her personal reaction on August 27 in her diary. She continued to be amazed at the low price that was being asked. Even though the board had suspended action at Avondale, she pledged herself to secure the land and said, I will settle it with poor families. I will have missionary families come out from America. She made reference to a previous dream in which God confirmed that with proper cultivation, the land would yield a bountiful harvest, which has since proven true. And going on, she said, having had this matter presented to me at different times, I am more than ever convinced that this is the right location. 3 days later, she added in her diary that Rousseau and Daniels were opposed. They said the land at Avondale was no good. They said we would be disappointed in cultivating. It's not rich enough to produce good crops. She disagreed with them strongly. She said, we knew we had evidence that the Lord had directed in the purchase of the land, probably thinking of McCulloch's healing, among other things. They proposed still searching for land, and Ellen White objected again. She said, look, We've already spent a lot of money, time, and anxiety getting the search underway. There were objectionable features in every other location that we found. The Avondale site is still the best as far as the advantages are concerned. And to go back on this now means more loss of time, more expense and outlay of means, great anxiety and uneasiness, and a delay in location, and a delay that's going to cost us a year in getting this place started. She said, God set a table in the wilderness for Israel, and he'll do it for us here. Why don't you men have more faith? And she talked for some time with these two brethren. They were very firm and decided that stop work at Avondale. And she said, after they left, a weight was on my soul. I felt dazed and too amazed to sleep. I knew from the light given that we'd made no mistake in selecting the Avondale site. Well, in the meantime, they had camp meeting for a couple of weeks at Ashfield. And no decisive action was yet taken regarding any location for the school. On Sunday, November 4, she wrote her impressions in her diary. She said, this morning I awoke repeating some words to my son Willie. Be careful that you do not show any distrust of God in your decisions concerning the land on which our school should be located. God is your counselor, and we are always in danger of showing distrust of God when we seek the advice and counsel of men who do not make God their trust and who are so devoid of wisdom that they do not recognize God as infinite in wisdom. We are to acknowledge God in all our counsels. When we ask him concerning anything, we are to believe that we receive things we ask. And if you depend on men who do not love and fear God, who do not obey his commandments, you will surely be brought into very difficult places. Those who are not connected with God are connected with the enemy of God, and the enemy will work through them to lead us into false paths. We do not honor God when we go aside to inquire of the God of Ekron. Then she summoned Willie and A.G. Daniels, and in most earnest tones demanded of them, is there not a God in Israel that you've turned to the God of Ekron? Monday, the next day, she addressed a letter to the committee who would be returning to re-examine Avondale, and she said, as you go to Door Creek, my prayer shall follow you. This is an important mission, and angels of God will accompany you. We are to watch and pray and believe and trust in God and look to him every moment. Satan is watching to communicate to you through men those things which will not be in harmony with the mind and will and work of God. Only believe. Pray in faith, as did Elijah. Let prayer be the breath of the soul. Where will God direct to locate the school? The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. In the meantime, the Foreign Mission Board at Battle Creek could not escape the conviction that they had blundered. Well, that was what was offered for sale. Yeah. It was offered as a parcel, see. Okay, back in Battle Creek, Foreign Mission Board could not escape the conviction. The Holy Spirit was working on them, too. That they had blundered, that they'd made a mistake in counseling delay and postponing development of the Avondale site. And so they rescinded their earlier action. They notified the brethren in Australia accordingly. And on November 20, the Australian Union Committee voted to proceed with the development of Avondale. So they didn't really lose a year, as she was afraid they would, but they did lose a little time. July of 1895, Ellen White bought 66 acres of her own. She named the estate Sunnyside. Next month, she moved four tents on the land for offices, bedroom, kitchen, accommodation for helpers, and she demonstrated in her own garden that the land would produce abundantly a splendid harvest of fruits and vegetables. Now we come to the furrow story, and I'm sure some of you wondered, why didn't I bring this in before? Well, there's a little bit of question about the furrow story raised by some critics, and there is a basis for raising a little question, as we'll notice now. At one point during the negotiation over the Avondale site, Ellen White had a vision, and it is included in Appendix A, which follows the outline of this presentation. We will not turn to it, however, now. You can read it later. Now, there are two accounts of this experience from her pen. One was written 3 or 4 years later, 1898, and the other was written 13 years later when she was back in the United States in 1907. In the 1898 account, written 3 or 4 years after the experience, the sequence seems to be as follows. First, she had the dream, before I visited Currumbong, perhaps for the first time, we can't be sure. She related the dream to Starr and his wife, members of her family. The next day, she said, we were on the cars, which was the expression they used to describe a railroad coach in those days. on our way to meet others who were investigating the land. And as I was afterward walking on the ground, lo, there was a furrow. And the men who had criticized the appearance of the land, this furrow was about 6 feet long and about 9 inches deep. And words were spoken just as I had dreamed. In the dream, she saw this furrow, and she saw men criticizing the land, said the soil was lousy. And the angel in the dream, is either angel or Jesus, said to her, false testimony has been born concerning this land. Well, after the party returned to a rented cottage, a council was held, and there was a vote to buy the land. McCulloch was present. He was seriously ill. They had a season of prayer. He was healed. Subsequently, there was a change of mind in regard to the Avondale site and a year's delay. Finally, the land at Avondale was accepted. This would locate the dream then as prior to the rail journey of May 23 and the fulfillment in the afternoon of May 23. Now, in the 1907 account, which was again 13 years later, the incident seems to have a different context historically at a later time, coming following the decision to halt development of the Avondale site and prior to the decision to continue with such development. And documentary materials will be found in Appendix B. We won't turn to that at this moment. Arthur White seems to favor the later date rather than the earlier date in the biographical account, noting in passing that neither of the two accounts of this experience fixes precisely the time of the dream and later seeing the furrow on the school land. In 1921, Willie White, who was there, placed the event as following the Ashfield camp meeting, which is probably why Arthur White chooses the later date rather than the earlier date, when a large committee were sent up to give the land another examination. But Arthur White makes what I think is a very cogent point when he says, an inability to fix precisely the exact timing or to point out the exact location of the furrow, which cannot be located, you know, within 3 feet today, of that furrow, this cannot undercut the validity of the vision and its fulfillment. Some critics have tended to write off the McCulloch story, the furrow story, and McCulloch is one of them. McCulloch later resigned as a minister of our church in 1897. Then, that was in March of 1897, 9-10 months later, January 24, 1899, he withdrew earlier critical statements and he made an extended confession of error. And he was reinstated as a worker in the church subsequently. But then, a couple of years later, probably in early 1902, McCulloch withdrew again in a second letter of resignation. And he prepared a signed statement, which was published in 1939 by one of the Ballingers in a magazine called The Gathering Call, a very critical magazine which criticizes Ellen White, the Adventist Church, and so on. And he says in this signed statement that he was the one who gave Ellen White the details of the furrow story, and that his information was the origin of her so-called vision. Even Adventist historian Dr. Milton Cook, who used to teach at Avondale and is still, I think, in the division there, in an interesting catalog of Adventist myths published in the Australasian Record of 1979, even Cook says flatly, the sighting of the furrow on the Avondale estate was not a determinative factor for the selection of the college site. However, Cook, in that article, does not elaborate further, but simply cites in a footnote references to Ellen White letters 29 and 122 of 1894, and I looked up both of those documents, and I can't figure out from those two letters what Milton Cook is talking about, but maybe I'm a little too obtuse. Anyway, conclusion. The Avondale School was formally opened April 28, 1897. Irwin was principal of the school from 1903 to 1908. Incidentally, Daniels incorrectly indicates Irwin's tenure as 8 years in Abiding Gift. It was from 1903 to 1908. Daniels was probably thinking of the terminus, 1908, and thinking, well, he'd been principal for all the years in the 20th century. Anyway, in 1909, the year after Irwin left the principalship, And 12 years after the school opened, Irwin wrote, "As time has gone on, and we have an opportunity to watch the work develop, we can say most assuredly from our own experience that God led in the selection of this place. Everything that has been said about the location of the school has been fulfilled. Everything." So it's one of the amazing chapters in the history of this church, and a very exciting one, and especially interesting to me now that I have been there. I was not there at the time of harvest, but Dr. Olson, you visited there. In fact, you took an airplane ride over the place. I've heard him tell this story, that he took an airplane ride over the school at the time of harvest, and he looked down and he saw all these crops down there, and he had a bird's eye view of literal fulfillment of what Ellen White said, that the Lord would spread a banquet in the wilderness. Yes. Well, the way the story was told in the earlier of the two Ellen White accounts, before she, at least the context seems to be, that before she ever got up there the first time, she had a vision. Maybe it was the night before she went up on the train. And on the train, she was telling Starr, G.B. Starr, George Starr, and his wife, and the others who were with her, she said, "I saw a furrow right out there located in a forested area." She said it was about 6 feet long and about 9 inches deep, if I'm not mistaken, details. And she said she saw a couple of men standing there, running the soil through their fingers and criticizing it. I think they were American missionaries who'd come from Iowa. And if you've ever been to Iowa, you know how black the soil is there and how rich and productive. And one of them was saying to the other, "Well, this soil is lousy." And Ellen White said, and I've forgotten the exact word, whether it's my guide or my companion, anyway, it was either the angel or Jesus, said to her, "False testimony has been born about this land." And she told that to Starr and his wife and whoever else was with her on the train. I think Willie was already up at Avondale at this time. And when they got there, within 24 hours, they were out there, and all of a sudden, I guess just off of Dora Creek, they found a furrow out here in a wilderness area. And as the story has been told, and I have not been able to verify this detail, and sometimes details get added to stories to make them interesting in telling, but I've not verified this detail. But anyway, according to the way the story has been told, there was no evidence that a horse had been through there, you know, with a plow to make the furrow. There was no evidence of a cart, you know, wheels and so on, in the soil. There was just this furrow. And they came upon, while they were standing there looking at this empty furrow, two missionaries came up, sampled the soil, and said, "This is lousy soil." And Ellen White looks at Starr and said, "What did I tell you?" Now, that's the story. And the question is, two questions, actually. Where was that furrow? And today, you go there, there's a monument that says within about 100 yards of here, there was a furrow. And that's as close as they can come today. I've seen the monument. It's right over there near the cafeteria. They can't locate today the very precise piece of ground on which this 6-foot furrow was located. And today, there's some question about, did it happen before Ellen White's first visit to Avondale, or did it happen on a subsequent visit? And there are two different accounts, both from her pen, and one seems to suggest a later date than the other. However, keep also in mind that the later date is suggested in a much later account, and you know, memories play tricks with us sometimes. I was at the Oregon camp meeting just last week, and Gladstone Park. I had been there 3 years before, and I went out for my morning 2 miles, 3 miles, and I thought, I'm going to walk up to a certain shopping center. And I got up to the street, and one store was on the wrong side of the street, and the shopping center did not exist, and the Adventist church was not where it was supposed to be. And this is only 3 years. And I realized the fallibility of human memory. And Ellen White wrote the second of these two accounts years later, and it was many years later that Willie tended to put the story later than we have generally told it. We have generally told the story as having taken place the afternoon before they went up there. Yes? I have not heard that detail. As I say, some of these details get added with the telling, and that may have happened, but I have not been able to verify that in the written accounts. I know that, in fact, I have been guilty of, I think, unwittingly embroidering some stories myself. We've got to be awfully careful on that. Yes. Yeah.
She said she was 12 and she was baptized. But you go back and check in the church records in that Methodist church, it was 1842, so she was 14 and a half.
Uh-huh.
So she could easily have had a slip of memory when she's telling
sure.
that account.
And also, when she wrote her first autobiography in 1860, yes, Milton Hook. Did I say Cook? Is that what it says in the outline? Oh, my stars. Well, you see, that shows you I'm not infallible. yes, it is Hook. And did I put it Hook one place? Okay, well, anyway, thank you. Would you, on the last page of the text, would you change the C to an H? Yeah, it is Milton Cook. It is Milton Hook. I guess because there was a Captain Cook, for whom they named the Cook Islands, by the way. When I first went to the Cook Islands, I thought the reason they named those islands the Cook Islands was because the women knew how to cook food like you've never eaten anywhere in the world. But that's not why they named them the Cook Islands. All right. Yes?
Could you please comment on the role which Peter Vessel played in financing the site? Didn't there come some money from Africa?
Yes, I believe Peter Wessels did send some money. Dr. Olson, you probably are more familiar with that than I am.
From Anna Wessels, the first $5,000 that bought the land came from her. And then another $5,000 came, I think that was on a loan basis. But really, they did supply the money.
Ellen White often had to get private funding for her projects. The Paradise Valley Sanitarium, she had to borrow $2,000 from a lady, Josephine Gottsian, I believe was the name, and she borrowed $2,000 on her own signature at the bank to pay for the land, the Brethren of the Southern California Conference, because Southeastern was then, all of it was Southern California, I believe, and the Brethren said, no way are we going to put money into a spa in which two medical doctors successively went to the wall in bankruptcy. It didn't look like paradise. You know, it was called Paradise Valley. It looked like the other place. They'd had a drought there. But, no, Ellen White often had to get funding for these things from private sources. Yeah, two questions.
Did she ever have to pay off any of these herself?
I don't know. Do you, Dr. Olson? I do know this because I researched it. Back in 1980, when there was all this criticism of Ellen White and exploiting church members, she often borrowed money from a colporteur. What was his name? He loaned her money. Harper. Walter Harper. Walter Harper often loaned her money. She'd write and say, Walter, I need $1,000, and Walter would send it to her. And she paid Walter Harper interest, and I checked the rate of interest that she paid, and she was paying 1 to 1.5% higher than the banks were paying. I checked this in a reference library. And at the time that she borrowed the money and paid Walter, she was paying him between 1% and 1.5% more than Walter could have got at the bank. So she did. Question?
Yes. Did the Brethren eventually buy the entire 1,500 acres?
That's it is my understanding that they did. Now, she bought 66 of that, and I think they probably sold off some sites for building houses and so on. I know they did. PUC, when PUC was located, they bought 2,800 acres, and then they subsequently sold off 1,000, and the PUC campus today is 1,858 or something like that. So when PUC was located, they bought 2,800 and then sold 1,000 off. They sold her 66, and there may have been others that bought sites, but it's my understanding they got the whole 1,500.
What about the student body today?
Oh, I don't know the number, and I was there, too. There's a lot of them.
Just curious.
Yeah, I would... About 500. It's a good-sized student body. And let me tell you this, because I was just there last October. There is a good spirit there. Those young people are tremendous, and they've got a good faculty there, and there's a good spirit in the school. Yes.
Obviously, the Lord wanted Ellen White there. But did the brethren try to put her away by sending her down there?
Well, I learned at a recent seminar at PUC, Dr. Olson made a presentation that I had not heard before, and he took the position that they were trying to get her out of the country. Now, you see, 1891 is only 3 years after 1888. Now, Dr. Olson and I usually agree on everything. All right. I want to see the whole thing, because all I saw was just a couple of sentences, and I thought you were really straining something, Bob. The reason why I tend to be a little skeptical is this. Usually associated with that is a parallel statement that, you see, this is all tied to 1888, and I guess Dr. Olson's going to prove his point to you tomorrow, that 3 years later, the brethren were so upset with Ellen White, they wanted to get her out of the country. All right, that was 1891. 1892, Steps to Christ was published, and the first edition of Steps to Christ was published by Fleming H. Revell, a non-denominational religious publisher, who still print literature, by the way. Their headquarters today is Old Tappan, New Jersey. And it is alleged, and I've got documentation on this from our vault, it is alleged that this is just another instance whereby the brethren were dragging their feet, because Steps to Christ is her classic statement on righteousness by faith, and that the brethren were so against righteousness by faith that the denominational publishing houses wouldn't print Steps to Christ, and she had to go outside. Now, that's the story that's alleged. I've got documentation to prove that isn't what happened. She went outside because she wanted to get a broader audience than denominational publication would assure, and the Review and Herald screamed bloody murder when they did it. And after the first edition was published, she bought the copyright back from Fleming Revell, gave it to the Review, and said, "Here you are." So because that story is tied with the other story, and I have disproved the Fleming Revell thing, I'm very skeptical that the brethren railroaded her out to Australia, but tomorrow I will look at your evidence.
This concludes another lecture from the 1986 E.G. White Estate Prophetic Guidance Seminar held at Andrews University. As a service to the church and in cooperation with the E.G. White Estate, this has been a special American Cassette Ministries production. International copyright, 1986, all rights reserved.
To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries have been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.